Let it rip.
Blog Talk Radio.
Paul Fleming, I believe, and the lovely Sally from
Hi, Angie. Hi, everybody.
Hey, good morning, everybody. How are you, Paul? How are you, Patty?
Oh, Patty, yeah, Patty's fine. Paul's not here right now. He's nipped out. I'm here on my own.
Oh, okay. Well, Patty, it's great to have you on the show, and welcome.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Patty.
That's all right.
Perhaps what we can do is start off playing Don't Go Blaming Me with Coyote Rex.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you've heard that? Okay, yeah. You insist, yeah.
Don't you go blaming me.
What a great cut.
That's a Coyote Rex.
Yeah, nice one.
Wow.
So Patty, please tell us about the writing of this song. Where did you record it, and how long have you been performing it?
Oh, well, this song was recorded around 2007, 2008, maybe. It was just during Billy Fleming, the drummer, in his studio at the time, and it was really, we only had was like a 8-track Zoom machine to do it on, and it's amazing that it came out that well, really.
That's
wonderful.
You
know, it's good when you, in some ways, when you work like that, it's really good because it limits you. You can't go over the top and stuff, you know. You can only do what will fit in the machine. Yeah, you can bounce around. It gets really complicated.
Yeah.
It's kind of self-producing, really, when you do it that way.
Yeah, it's true. Very true. Yeah, but it's wonderful. I thought it had a haunting. You were saying, Rick, and Sally, I know that you guys are both, you're probably more fluent with Patty's music, but I love this. I love this blues that sounds so raw and real.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I loved about it from the first time I heard it. In fact, I think it's the first song that I heard by Patty. We have a mutual friend who had a radio show, Richard Everett. He had an excellent show, and he played something by Patty. I think it was that one. And that's how we got to know each other. And what's interesting was I said that it has almost what you think of almost like a Native American sort of hypnotic beat. And Patty was saying that he drew a bit on, you know, kind of a bit on a raga, too. It's, you know, so we have both Indians covered, the Indian Indians and the woo-woo Indians like Rick. But it is a fantastic song. So what did lead to the writing of that one?
Oh, well, I was going through a really bad time at that time, really. And I don't know, I had a few relationship problems, different things. And I was surrounded by people who are kind of, what's the best way of putting it, quasi-spiritual. You know, they talked about all the things they do about it. To me, it seemed that they weren't really that spiritual at all. And I was pretty strung out at that time. So it was a bit vitriolic. It's about somebody. I'm not going to say who it's about. I was definitely very healthy with that one. But occasionally we still do the song. I'm not doing it at the moment, but I'm going to revisit it again and learn to play it that way again. I think it's kind of evolved over hundreds of gigs, and it needs to go back to where it needs to be, which is like that. You know, next time. Now Coyotes don't play that often. We don't often get a chance to play together now. But we're planning a few shows this year, so it'll be back on the list, you know. Yeah.
Terrific.
I know that you did play that one. I saw a video where you were playing that, and the good poet that you were working with at the time, Tom Rowe, was speaking his poetry over the song. It was really something.
Yeah, I do it. I did a gig recently, a thing called the Festival of the Beat in Ipswich with John Rowe and a load of other poets and musicians. We clearly did the same thing, you know, like if I sing that and John does the thing, or the other way around, depending how we do it. But that show I do with John Rowe is what we call it Serious Time. And it's like John's poetry and narrative with me doing music and some of my songs. We look at it like it's kind of a traveling newspaper, really. You know, every time we play, we adapt to what's actually going on in the world. You know? It's good
you
narrative.
Texas. He regularly plays in prisons. You know, you go to Texas and you play, prisons and just, anywhere where people might need it most.
Yeah, sure. Huh. I mean, we've done a few things.
Wait a minute, Wait a minute. I want to hear about this. Now, just back up. What is this about? What are you doing playing in prisons?
Oh, well, you know, John does work in prisons anyway. He does lots of, workshops, writing workshops. He's very popular amongst the inmates here and there. He does a good job, you know. And so every so often we've done a couple of three shows in a prison, you know, with a few other people as well.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a weird experience, you know. It's nice when somebody comes up to you and says, you know, one of the guys in prison came up and said, you know, that's really sorted my head out, man. You know, thanks for that. And you know,
That would make my day to think I'd fucking given some kind of respite to, you know, someone doing hard time. That's a really noble thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it felt good, you know, and I think we'll probably do some more. We may not, but we every so often we get a decent show somewhere, and we do it. We're planning to do some more. It's quite a bizarre concept, really, the way we do it, but people like it, you know, so that's fine.
That's fantastic.
Okay, listen, Patty, would you do me a favor and give me a rundown and an intro on One More Dance, which sounds like a much happier place you were in your head?
Oh, yeah, well, One More Dance is off the new album, and, I had the song for some time.
Now, wait a minute, that's the album called Finally, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Which I did before here, in this studio here, and Paul wrote a few, wrote another verse, I think, because I was always missing a verse in there. And we got Mark Flanagan, who's Jules Holland's guitarist, to play on it. And he played all the kind of the instruments. I mean, he's great. I mean, Flanagan even played on George Harrison album. You know, he's a good guy.
Right.
He's a nice guy. And so funny song, really. I don't really... Again, that was like about a kind of separation that happened with me and somebody. But it's a cheerful little ditty.
Well, here we go. Let's hear it.
Oh dear, don't ever let the fear take you apart. For in truth, you're destined to ride eyes on and steer most carefully when you're in the docks. We're in truth, there is an horizon to guide you. Wanted more of looking up something, not a lot more they can do. Another chance to see what they can hide in. One more dance and the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, oh, the river is time. And dear, the six sad moments of night will pass, 'cause you're destined to rise above them. And dear, your love's the kind that makes the waves part, 'cause in truth you are a survivor. And in the dark I hold your face before me, hear the night wind moan and sigh. There's a star I think it comes to guide me. One more dance and the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, for the river is time. Well, they never listened and they couldn't understand. It's all in the dancing. Come on, baby, won't you hold my hand? For one more dance and the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, oh, the river is tied. Heaven's closer than you think. Cut the cord and see where we can sail to. One more dance and the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, the river shall be mine. One more dance, for the river is tied.
I mean, I think, you know, the whole concept.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Could you speak up?
The whole concept of the album really is to take what Paul figured was good songs, you know, and produce them in a way that other people can hear them and maybe even want to do them themselves, which is where the money lies. So,
yeah,
you know,
I like that song. It's wonderful.
That's nice.
I wondered if I could ask you a question. I noticed that I have done some work with Mick Taylor, who's an old buddy of mine. How long ago is it since you worked with him?
Oh, no. Well, Mick came and played on two tracks of an album I was doing with a guy called Ian Harvey. I'd written a load of lyrics and I wrote the song and sang most of them. And what happened was it's about 3 years ago. I saw Mick. I went round his house and he asked me where I was going that day. And I said, "Well, I'm going in the studio." And he said, "Well, can I come?" So I said, "Yeah." And then he played some great live and stuff on two tracks. I mean, it was he played on our album, not you know, I play on Mick's album, no. that was a great privilege, and Mick's a nice guy, so that was it really.
He's a charming person. I looked at it and I was so happy, Sally, that you mentioned it when you sent the bio notes. I was like, oh, cool. I didn't know Mick had been up to recently.
Philly is a village, and I figured that you probably knew Mick yourself, you know, because, you know, there's a bit of a long history there with you and the Stones. Also, another overlap that I thought was so interesting was that Patty has written and worked with the Levelers. And it's strange because Kevin and I have recently seen the Levelers perform along with the Ruts. And, of course, you're close to the Ruts. And Patty worked for with the Levelers, so here's another example of how world.
They're all joined together, aren't they? It's lovely that the tapestry of our musical lives it's a good thing.
Oh, I would think so. Sure. Explain about that one, Patty. How did you start with the Levelers?
Well, you see, there's a myth. A popular myth that says that I'm an ex-Leveler. I've never been a Leveler, but I knew one of the Levelers, Simon Friend, from way before the Levelers really happened. And then I met them when it did happen in Up Next Style in the early 90s. I met them in 1995 and kind of reunited with Simon Friend, who's never I know. And then a few years later, they got me to do some B-sides for the Sync, and those things went on to the compilation album. And then they, a few more years later, they got me to write some songs, and they put one of the one called Believers on an album called Green Blade Rising, which did quite well. And then another obscure B-side. But most of these things have been released on compilations or on re-releases, you know, and stuff. So it kind of gave me a credibility stamp, you know. And they're mates, you know, they're good friends. I still see them occasionally.
That's wonderful. Now, where did you guys play in the States?
Oh, I don't know. The Levelers. I don't know. They did a few tours, I think. There, I don't think it ever really worked for them in the States. You know. I mean, I did a gig with Simon Friend in 2004, I think it was, in Boston. At a place called the Middle East Club, and we thought that was actually a benefit for the hurricane that had happened in Grenada, I seem to remember. I don't think the Levelers wanted to go, so they sent Simon and me instead. So I thought, you know, it was a bizarre experience staying in the Omni Parker Hotel, everything paid for and all that sort of thing. You know, next to the presidential suite. almost got to be a rock star. I remember standing outside on the having a fag and that's a cigarette. I mean, not the fag. And some kids walked by and said, "Hey, you rock stars!" And I said, "Well, it looks like it now." You know, yeah.
Perfect.
Bizarre experience, really. But yeah, good though. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's wild.
Yeah. It was good stuff. These things, I never imagined any of these things would happen. It's like meeting any of the musicians I've worked with, all the famous ones, or it's kind of accidental, really, you know. And that's it. There's no logic to it. Nothing's been contrived. Oh, I must meet so and so. You know, just people come to you, don't they? And bump into them here and there. That's I'm like a satellite, you know, for a periphery person. Occasionally, my orbit gets sucked in near the star. You know.
I love it.
That's
Quite a bit too with Peter Davies, and I know he was with the Youth Subs. You know, he's had a pretty long career too, and he was on wasn't he on the Grail Brotherhood?
He played on most of that, and he also played on the YouTube version of Save It to St. Louis, which is back on the finals. He's not on that album, but he's on the original version we did for YouTube. And I've recorded quite a lot of stuff. I've got in the can with Pete playing drums. And I'm going to finish it off. It's just that I haven't really had time. But it's good, and it's a bit off the wall as well, which is even better, really. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Must get back. Yeah, Pete's a great guy.
I was just looking for the song that I've got from the Grail Brotherhood, and I'm having a heck of a time finding it. Carry on chatting, Sally.
Okay, well, what I'd like to know is, now, sometimes when you ask about musical influences, like as you're growing up, sometimes you get something very different from what you might have expected from hearing an artist's material. But besides Rex Harrison and the Spotniks, you know, who was it? I remember I posted, it was Hava Nagila by the Spotniks, and I remember you said your mother liked that one an awful lot. And I do hear a lot of Bo Winberg twang in the way you play. But who else did you grow up listening to, you know, who, you know, set you on this, you know, the path of being a musician?
Oh, well, you know, going back from a little kid, you know, I'm born in 1965, so, you know, I suppose it was kind of rock and roll going on. I wasn't that keen, really. I think the first thing that really got me, believe it or not, is Frank Ifield, I Remember You, which was a real big hit. And then there was, I suppose there was The Shadows, Cliff and The Shadows was a big deal thing then. And then, Joe Brown and the Brothers, you know? Brothers.
I loved him.
Joe was just, to me, was probably, I'm sure Joe must have been the thing that really got me wanting to play. And then, of course, the Beatles thing happened as well, you know, and that made everybody want to play. And my, you know, I think I was about 6 or 7 maybe, when I got the first guitar. My brother started to learn to play it, showed me how to do a few things, and by the time I was about 14, I could actually play it properly, you know. But I don't know anything about music. I mean, I don't know anything about the notes or anything. I'd still play ear, you know. And that's it, really.
Well, we know what we like.
You know.
We do know what we like, at least, yeah. When you were, the first time you ever played live, I mean, did you do a covers or, you know, did you do your own material? And if it was a cover, who was it?
Always, I think once, I once played, I had a friend who had classical guitar lessons, and he said, "Oh, come along." I was about 14, and this guy did his classical lesson. And at the end of it, this guitar teacher said, "Oh, Martin says you can play guitar, perhaps you'd like to show me what you can do." So I played my very introverted version of "Where Do All the Flowers Go," and the teacher says, "Don, my advice to you is to give up. You'll never be a guitarist." Well, I thought, well, I know what I thought about that.
How rude.
So, where were we? What was the question again? I've lost it. Sorry.
At least you didn't get discouraged from it. Yeah. Well, we've talked a little bit about, you know, folks who've crossed your path. And, of course, we were... Tell a little bit about when you met Steve Marriott. That was really something.
Yeah, that was again one of their blue things. I knew the club owner, and you know, at the time Steve was playing places that were no better than the places I was playing. You know, it's ridiculous, really. And anyway, he was brilliant. He had a four-piece band with him, and he was just brilliant. And anyway, at the end of the set, you know, it played brilliantly, and the people who were there loved it. But the DJ guy hadn't got a clue, really, who he was, and just kind of switched the sounds on again.
Yeah.
You know, then they're trying to get him to go back on again because he said no. So, anyway, I, you know, kind of lagged it to the dressing room and spent a few hours with him. And I just a brilliant guy. He was such a nice bloke. You know, he had wasn't dismissive of me, you know. In fact, it's very encouraging, and you know, he kind of sussed where I was coming from and music and stuff, and told me to carry on. You know, God
that's
bless
so
him.
Nice.
Yeah,
he was such a nice person.
Yeah, yeah, he was. He was
did you know him, Angie? Did you know him well, Angie?
Yeah, I knew him quite well. I helped him organize his publishing.
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. It was literally that. He called me up and he asked me if I would, and I went down to a studio in the countryside and I spent 3 days there listening to the biggest library of music. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
Just to try to organize it so that he could get a proper publishing deal to go ahead and, you know, finance whatever it was he wanted to do next. But he was wonderful. And we are so lucky because Patty Stratton is with us today. And one of the tracks that he did for the Grail Brotherhood is "When I," and here it comes.
Hey.
Mm-hmm.
When I go down, I'll take you with me. When I go down, we'll sink like stones. When I go down, I know where you'll be. When I go down, I'll drag your bone. Mm-hmm. I'll drag your bone. When I catch fire, you and me don't need. When I catch fire, that's what we'll do. When I catch fire, you'll feel it. When I catch fire, oh, you burn too. We'll be right back.
That is some song.
Woo, great stuff.
I love Ian's backing vocals on that, too. It all comes together so well. I remember you were describing it almost like a New Orleans funeral march.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's a wonderful song.
I think that the thing is that the Grail Brotherhood project was Ian had, like I say, loads of lyrics, and they asked me if I'd write the songs and sing them, really. I mean, there's one song that Ian sings in the middle, Under One Roof, but, you know, so it was like, let's get some songs together. It worked really well, and then I had, really had to kind of think about acting the part, you know, because they're like narratives, aren't they? The lyrics and so it was very much kind of acting, you know, the scene set, and then you deliver it in that way, which I enjoy doing a great deal. I hope sometimes to do a follow up with it in some time, you know. Let's hope we do.
That would be great.
Know.
It really
that
fits
would be
your
fantastic.
Style. I love that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had talked about, because I was saying, you know, you're such a, you know, genial guy, and then there is this very, you know, it's a very dark song, very, and you, we were talking a little bit about acting in music, you know, when you're delivering. And I remember you were saying, you were talking about growing up and seeing in My Fair Lady, you know, Rex Harrison got all these accolades for singing. And he didn't know, he didn't really sing. You know, he was like, oh, I can't sing. But the characters he played.
Say this about singing. He said, well, you know, mm-hmm. Rex Harrison couldn't sing. But, you know, it's the way he spoke the lyrics. And the phrasing, you know, the phrasing and the tonality of the voice, it does magic, you know. And that's how a lot of people work with it. I think, you know, everybody should have an element of that when they're trying, you know, singing. You can sing standard style things, you know, but I mean, I haven't got the most technically perfect voice. So better to go that way and kind of act it out, you know. Think to me anyway.
Okay, I got a question though. Who were you playing as far as like this you know, what kind of character was in your mind while you were doing this one?
Well, I suppose they're difficult lyrics, aren't they? You know, I mean, Ian. I don't know where Ian said this at when he wrote the lyrics. I suppose that could be a, you know, I don't know, maybe it's a kind of vengeful, I'd just have to be kind of slightly vengeful character in there, you know.
There is
like,
a vengefulness. It's almost like, yeah. Like I was saying, sort of a, you know, God, you know, and a thank you. It's so strange because it doesn't quite square with when, you know, we're talking together. But then you hear the song and I'm saying, what were you, you know, you must have been reaching for, you know, pretty deep for that one.
Yeah, well, yeah, so you have, yeah, you do. It's just, it is like acting. You know, you have to put yourself in, create a character that fits that vibe, you know. And that's it. You know, you can't do anything else. Do it any other way, it doesn't work.
That's right.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about a follow-up project to this one. Have you already started working on it?
No. I mean, I'm starting to dig out some ideas again and think about stuff. I hope to do some more work with Paul Fitzgerald here. We're probably going to do another one sooner or later. I'm quite slow at putting that there were. Two albums in 3 years. It's amazing, really. You know, there's usually about a 10-year gap between anything I do. it's because I can't sell anything, and it costs money and stuff. I mean, I was lucky these last couple of things really been done under with the benevolence of others, you know, and the production's good because we've been doing it in good studios, you know. Well, Paul's studio, especially here, is excellent, you know. And you know, I wasn't ever really that convinced about modern music technology, Logic, and all those things, but I am now, believe me.
As long as it makes things easier. you know, provided it just makes things easier. Well, you were talking about two albums in a few years, but it sounds like the Grail Brotherhood was almost like a bunch of guys got together, went down to the studio, and had a great time.
Yeah, it sounds like,
you know,
it really was.
Like this was, you know, it wasn't all this, you know, sometimes some albums, they're in the planning stages for many years. But this sounds like there was spontaneity about it, and it just sort of caught fire and worked.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, there's a few people on there who all, you know, contribute here and there. And some people were actually there at some point. Some, there's a guy called Ham Brockman, who's a friend in America, and he, you know, he put a bit of guitar on. I think it's the first track, I'm not sure now. He didn't have to get on an airplane to come here to do that, you know. So that's good, you know. And that's probably the way to go, maybe on the next thing. There's a few people that we can get involved, but it's probably easier for
Patty,
their time.
Patty, let's just see if we can. I want to try to make it possible. If there are folks who are listening to the show or who listen to the podcast later, where can they get your work? Is there a website? Is there a particular place where the songs are available to buy? Could you fill us in on all that? And also, are you planning on doing a tour for the new album finally? And if so, where are you going to be going? If you could give us all of that information, that would be incredible.
Yeah. Well, the Finally album is on Bandcamp, I think. Yeah, Bandcamp, which is an easy thing to get onto, you know, on the net. And people can download from there. If they go to Paddy Stratton Music Facebook page, they can message me there. If they want an actual CD copy, you know, we can arrange for them to get it.
Right.
I'm trying to negotiate a distribution thing at the moment, but it's not that easy to do, as you're probably well aware. So that's really it, really. That's available there. Similarly, the Grail Brotherhood thing is available. If you put a search in there, you can find it on, I think, probably Bandcamp and a load of other things like iTunes and all those things. We're actually probably, hopefully, we're going to put all of this stuff up. The new stuff, especially on iTunes and damn it, Spotify as well. You know, I mean, it has to be done. You've got to get people to hear it. And one of the good things about the modern music model is people will hear it, even if they don't necessarily buy it. And because it's that easy for them to rip it without paying for it. But that's just what you have to do, you know. Airplay is handy. You know, that's a few quid here and there as well. You know, depending on where it is. I mean, as for shows, the thing is, like, a lot of people who know me, throughout the world, the real problem is running a show where you know you've got a big enough catchment area to get people there, especially using some of the musicians I've got. So we're looking at it. We're looking at maybe a few kind of smaller kind of theatre shows. Again, it's a lot down to the logistics of getting people involved on, you know, to be able to do the show. The next stage will be that. And I'll continually going to update my Paddy Stratton Music Facebook page, which will have eventually any new stuff will go on there. And the more people go there and like it, they'll get notifications and, you know, we'll go that way, you know? Again, I'm probably going to negotiate with a quite decent distribution company soon. But you know, it's about multimedia diffusion. It's not just getting a deal with somebody, you know. And it has to be done by people who really know what they're doing. Otherwise, you might as well just forget, not bother, you know. I'm being not brutally honest.
Well, the right distribution is so necessary. But you were talking about how nobody had to jump a plane and come to the studio like they would have had to in the old days. And without modern technology, you know, that's how we work. Now you can work in several different countries, just send the WAV file.
Yeah.
and just slot it right in. And and anybody can be anywhere. So it does save a lot of time. It sure saves a lot of money.
yeah, it does. You know, it's a way ahead. I mean, people moan about, the music business isn't what it used to be. Well, you know, what was it like then? I ask them. You know, because I seem to remember it was pretty shit when I was involved in those years back. You know, the model's always been pretty bad. The modern music situation is in real terms, people have got more chance of being heard. And it's about them trying to coordinate publicity. And that's the hardest thing, is coordinating the publicity. You know, you get one happen, and then you've got to do another thing. And that is the real key to it, you know. There's lots of myths about people make it by just sticking it on the internet. Well, not unless they've got somebody really smart behind them, you know. Unfortunately.
Well, it's pretty saturated because it is so do-it-yourself. There's a lot of chaff to weed through, to sift through until you get to the wheat. But I found that what happens is that usually online you can find the places, the sites and the groups or whatever, that will, center on the kind of music that you're looking for. And I think this is great.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the thing is, the more people do a Google search or whatever on me, the more they'll know. It's just the way it goes. The more people who like the page, or the more people like that, the more it goes up in the rankings of things, and people are more likely to find it. But if you look hard enough, you find pretty much everything. You'll also find some awful shit, actually, pardon my friend.
Oh, shit.
Well-meaning people have put up, which is, how could, you know, I wish you hadn't put that on there.
Yeah. Well, good thing is that it's what I really admired always about your music is that it's impossible to pigeonhole. You don't belong to any one single genre. It's you kind of mix them together and make it your own. And especially with the collaborations with others, is it folk? Is it, you know, rock? It doesn't really matter, but at least there's not this slavish devotion to one particular kind of music. It sounds like you could do just whatever you felt like.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, back to an earlier question, you say, well, you know, I forgot what the question was, but I now remember. You know, like when I started gigging, did I do other people's tunes? Well, the answer is no. The only other people's tunes I did was other writers that I was in the bands with, you know. Started off in a folk club in 1972 or something with a couple of mates, Phil Harrison and Tim Dawson. And, you know, we played our own tunes and realised we could do that. And it went down well, you know. So it started there, and then all sorts of experimental bands went on after that with different people. So I got into all sorts of stuff, you know, jazz rock and God knows what, really. And also lots of fuel for that sort of thing, you know, plenty of psychedelics and things. So, you know, got made lots of U-turns, went backwards and forwards, didn't have any particular success. But, you know, we did some good music. So I've always, and the people I've always dug have done, you know, I mean, not every Jefferson Airplane track is the same. Not every Grateful Dead track is the same. Certainly not every Beatles or Stone track is the same. And, you know, and it seems to me that's the way to go. It seems that people end up doing one style and then they get stuck there and expected to just do one style. And I think it's very restrictive. And it's also the end of a lot of decent bands because the marketing forces force them to do that and it dies, you know, or it survives.
Or else they grasp onto something, they get panicky and think, well, you know, now, you know, with the common, the trend, whatever the trend is now, we've got to do it. And they end up doing it, and it's not natural to them, and it ends up pretty dismal, you know, and you're just saying, it's almost like for a band to last a long time, they have to have almost a core sound. But it has to be elastic enough to accommodate the coming years.
Yeah, and that is it. And also, you know, there's a lot of padding. I mean, not everybody writes a song that people will remember. you know, they'll remember it once they've heard it loads of times. They'll dig the music or something. The real art for me is I don't put songs out unless I know that people won't be able to forget them, you know, whether they like it or not. You know, the hook's got to hit people, and if the hook hits them, then that's a good song. It's pointless trying to flog a dead horse, you know. Yeah.
Well, you keep the standards very high, and you always live up to them. But it's that, like I was saying, finally coming on the heels of the Grail Brotherhood was really great, because we didn't have to wait 10 years for another one from you.
Yeah.
And let's hope the next one hopefully soon.
Hopefully not another 10 years. Yeah.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think it'll take that long. It sounds like, you know, the wheels are already in motion once the momentum starts. It takes on a life of its own, and if you said that you were kind of already thinking of a follow-up to the Grail Brotherhood, then you've probably got half of it already done, even if it's in your own head.
Yeah, I think so. It's either going to be that, or it'll be another one with Paul, or it'll be something else. All the stuff that I've got in the can, you know, that I get out the can and start again, or redo stuff or whatever. Got a load of stuff. It really is about time management and also having the right mind on the day, you know, to do stuff. But not that easy to just go and that sounds right. The theme's got to be there, you know. And I suppose it's like all creative things. There are ebbs and flows in the process. And as I get older, the ebbs and flows get longer, you know. So I think that's really it. Also,
I guess I'm going to remind you to weed out the archives.
Okay. Excuse me. I wanted to say earlier, I think one of the things that we're ignoring is something really simple. What we need to do is we need to get videographers involved so that every time a show is done, we can then stream it on the internet.
Oh, I agree.
And I think that it would do the same thing that you've shown and proven, like Sally and Dream Foundry and everyone who's doing this stuff worldwide, that we could, you know, by showing the images of the folks actually doing the show, I think it would revive and resuscitate that desire to see folks playing live. And we might find that we could ignite a fuse.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, also, there is going to be any money made out of any of these things. You know, it is about marketing and product. You know, people have got to be able to buy it and persuade them to buy it. You know, in a world full of stuff. It needs that sort of innovation, doesn't it? Yeah. That's where I'm thinking about it now. I mean, we're working on a YouTube video here. Soon it'll be finished, I suppose, for the first track on Finally. It needs that. And there are a couple of Grail Brotherhood YouTube videos as well. And I've said before, the St. Louis track for the original version that Pete was on, and we Paul put together a real good video for that, because it's all about the Michael Brown shooting in, you know, St. Louis. It works. You know, people do go for that. They like to see that. And it gets the message across. You know, if it has got a message, that one has. Anyway, yeah, sure. Way to go.
Well, that'll be something to look forward to. But I guess I'll just have to every so often just sort of give you a nudge. Okay, Patty, it's time to weed out the archives. Go digging and see you've got. It doesn't hurt to have, you know, an external gadfly just, you know, kind of getting you going on these things.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Every so often I get inspired, though, by things and might kick me into action. Same with Coyote Rex. You know, we did a bit of recording last weekend, and I just wanted to see how some things would sound. Sounded good. The gig that we did a few weeks before that had Aidan Connell come up and play with. Aidan
Aidan Collins, a great blues star, new blues star. And it's a great privilege to have him come and play with us. So, you know, there's things that are possible, and no doubt will happen. You know, there's a good network of close friends who are trying very hard to help me and a load of other artists, you know. But as you know, it's a competitive world. And if you've got 1,000 people who dig you or 10,000 people who dig you, you've still got to get them to the place where you're going to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're all around the world, yeah, they all love it. But how can I fill that theatre, you know? With the right publicity, yeah, perhaps. There's a few good reviews. There's going to be a thing in the magazine. There'll be a few things soon, which will help. But if we don't coordinate that at the same time as that, then the energy will be dissipated and the show won't be full. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a risk to take.
Guys, we've got to say goodbye. I'm so sorry.
All right.
The hour has gone by. Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.
Sally, I really appreciate it. You bringing Patty to the show.
Absolutely.
And,
this has been great.
That's far out.
Thank you so much for having us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
You were great.
I look forward to seeing you and talking to you. I hope I'll get to see you, Patty. I'm looking forward to hearing more of your wonderful music. And you too, Sally.
Thank you, Angie. And you too, Angie. Hot seat.
All right,
take
care.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.